Not only did colonial policing influence Philippine state formation, but it also helped transform the U.S. federal government. Indeed, security techniques bred in the tropical hothouse of colonial governance were not contained at this periphery of American power. Through the invisible capillaries of empire, these innovations in intelligence percolated homeward to implant both personnel and policies inside the U.S. federal bureaucracy for the formation of a new internal security apparatus.
When Mark Twain said that a country could not be both a democracy at home and an empire overseas, the United States was just beginning to take over distant territories, most conspicuously the unruly Philippines. What was the cost at home of acquiring an empire abroad? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
How did the U.S. experience abroad 100 years ago give rise to surveillance techniques in use at home today? How does the American occupation of the Philippines compare with today's ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? What did we learn at the beginning of the 20th century that we may have forgotten at the dawn of the 21st? Our guest is Alfred McCoy, history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, co-editor of Colonial Crucible, Empire and the Making of the Modern American State, and author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, both published in 2009 by the UW Press.
Well, welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you, Emily.
Whenever I read your books, my jaw drops. It's this feeling of all these activities, all these governmental activities that I knew nothing about, and it's as if we've scratched the surface and seen something quite dark. I notice in your book, Policing America's Empire, that in your prologue, which you call Analogies of Empire, you say that rather than waiting to the end of the book to talk about parallels to Iraq and the present day, you're going to do it right at the beginning. And I wonder if you, before we talk about the Philippines, if you could say something about the way your work about the Philippines sheds light on today.
It really is a, if you will, an elaboration, a very extensive elaboration of Mark Twain's aphorism. You can't have democracy at home and empire abroad. And Twain derived this from looking at the U.S. pacification of the Philippines, which was ongoing through the last decade of his life. And what he observed was simply this, that the United States met massive resistance. We were trying, if you will, to overturn Asia's first national revolution. And this effort strained the then rather weak capacities of the American state, which one scholar has called a weak state, a patchwork state. And this required then the development of a whole new doctrine of intelligence and counterintelligence, an application of America's first information revolution, its vast industrial information technology, to the crushing of a national revolution. And in so doing, the United States created a whole new protocol of counterintelligence and a whole cadre of internal security specialists. And they created them at the periphery of empire. We formed something called the Philippines Constabulary, which was the first U.S. federal agency with a fully developed cover-out operational capacity. And then during the crisis of World War I, when the United States plunged itself into mobilization for global war for which it was completely unprepared, the United States believed that we were honeycombed with German spies, traveling spies that were everywhere that would damage our industrial plant and weaken our war effort. And so we launched this, what is history's most extensive internal security operation. And the progenitors of this operation were veteran intelligence and security specialists from the colonial Philippines. The father of U.S. military intelligence was an otherwise obscure Army medical doctor who led America's intelligence operations in the Philippines in 1901-1902. In the start of World War I, the United States was the only combatant in Western Europe whose army didn't have an intelligence service. We had no intelligence capacity. And so Ralph Van Diemen, Colonel Van Diemen, established the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence Division, and he is today regarded, esteemed as the father of U.S. military intelligence. He started with two officers, himself and an aide who would serve with him in the Philippines. They elaborated this into 1,700 men in the United States. They then amplified this into a civilian adjunct with 350,000 civilian spies. And they launched a distinctive internal security apparatus, a fusion of a state bureaucracy and a civil society movement. and civil society organizations that honeycombed American society for the next 50 years from World War I right through the end of the Cold War. The parallel with today is, I think, quite striking. Today we're fighting not just one protracted pacification under the rubric of the global war on terror, but we're fighting four of them from Somalia to the Philippines again, Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Philippines. The longest running is the Philippines. And this protracted global war on terror has once again strained the intelligence and counterintelligence capacities of the American state right to the breaking point, creating, if you will, a crucible of counterinsurgency which forges new, very sophisticated techniques of civil society surveillance, which are now, that we're entering our ninth year of the global war on terror, these are, in fact, just as happened in the Philippines before, these are percolating homeward through the invisible capillaries of empire to once again transform the U.S. federal government and, indeed, the relationship between the government and the society.
What was the U.S.'s strategy, if there even was one, in creating an empire? And how did the Philippines fit into that strategy?
It's kind of an interesting parallel. The United States hit a kind of a crisis of power in the 1890s, and within the Republican Party, there were bold visionaries like Theodore Roosevelt that felt that the kind of solution to America's crisis of closing the frontier and the decline of American masculinity, the lack of markets for our products, the resolution of matters spiritual, economic, was the acquisition of empire. And so they plunged us abroad. And the idea was we're going to take this small colony at the edge of Asia and we are going to transform America from a continental power into a world power. And there's a kind of a, I think, an interesting parallel by a later generation of Republican visionaries under President George W. Bush that would just insert ourselves in Iraq and through this single, simple, easy operation, go into Baghdad, take it over, they throw roses at us, and then we preside over the establishment of a model Arab democracy, and we will insert ourselves into the Middle East, a region which we've had kind of a toehold at best, and we will transform the whole of the Middle East, much as Theodore Roosevelt thought about America's presence transforming Asia.
And then stay in or withdraw?
Well, the American design is always get in, adjust the governance, and then pull out. That's, if you will, the genius of the American empire versus the Europeans. The European was very top-heavy, massive bureaucracies, scholars who give themselves over to generations of the study of arcane Orientalist texts to master the society from within. So a deep penetration and insertion of themselves over the span of literally centuries as the colonial power throughout Asia and ultimately Africa. The American style is very different. The American style operates in what I call a kind of superficial style of colonialism. So our approach to information and indeed to colonial rule is to manipulate societies not from within, but to manipulate them from without. So instead of learning languages, which Americans do badly, we collected in 1898 in the Philippines superficial things. We photograph everybody. We conduct a census, both a census of the entire population and a military census. The U.S. Metropolitan Police Department, which was an American police department, it was the most advanced police department under the American flag from 1899 to about the mid-1920s. By the mid-1920s, the Manila Police Department had photographic files on 70% of the population of the city of Manila. Okay, so it's this intensive, superficial survey, not looking for knowledge, okay, with all of its depth, but looking for information. Mm-hmm. And that is the American genius. And we're doing it again today. Our ultimate aim in the Middle East is not to move in and set up a government. No, it's to actually don the technological nine-league boots and to lift ourselves from the mud and dust of the Middle East up into the sky, into the ether. And through satellite technology, digital imaging, digital intercepts, with our aircraft flying overhead, our predator drones striking, to control the Middle East from the sky. And so this attribute of American imperialism, which has its origins in what I call America's first information revolution of the 1870s and 1880s, this has remained a defining attribute, if you will, a kind of a guiding American genius in our overseas adventures.
You talk about the Philippines as being sort of a laboratory where you try out things. And I'm curious, during this information revolution that you're talking about, what are some of the techniques, the technologies, the kinds of things we can do that we're trying to do abroad because we can't do them at home?
Well, first of all, let me talk about the America's First Information Revolution, because although everybody knows the pieces of the puzzle, nobody has actually put it together. And that's one of the things I did in this book. It's truly extraordinary when you look back from the 1870s to the 1880s. America, through its industrial and technological innovation, actually presided over what I would call the first American information revolution. And it produced innovations and ultimately a synergy in the realm of visual, textual, and statistical data. Beginning in the 1870s, what happened, let's say, is you could take Thomas Alva Edison's quadruplex telegraph, 1874, Philo Remington's typewriter, Alexander Graham Bell's telephone in 1876. What this meant was, for example, worldwide, you could transmit news from around the world via Morse code, and then a typist working with the Remington typewriter, working at the standard speed, which remained the standard speed for transmission recording for 100 years, at 40 words a minute, could actually encode data. So that was textual data. Then there were revolutions in visual data, Eastman's roll film, photographic printing, and then in the 1880s, a radical revolution in statistical data. An engineer named Hermann Hollerith developed the punch card. He patented it in 1889. And in just 2 weeks, in 1890, the U.S. enumerated the U.S. Census with 62 million Americans in just 2 weeks using the punch cards. Hollerith later became one of the founders of IBM. Okay, and then, of course, it's one thing to assemble this data and transmit it, but unless you can file it and retrieve it, it's useless. It's just a stack of information. In the 1870s as well, there were two American geniuses who came up, who invented collectively what I call the smart number. Not just an ordinal number, but an ordinal number that has information. One was Melville Dewey, who began cataloging the Amherst College Library in the 1870s and came up with the Dewey Decimal System. Another was Cutter, who began cataloging at the other end of the same small state, Massachusetts, the Boston Athenaeum Library. Cutter's system became the basis of the Library of Congress system. But more importantly, they invented the idea of the smart number, the coded number that allowed you to file data and retrieve it, moreover, to interface it. Okay? So through this system, America actually created the capacity not just for having a few spies follow a few kind of conspirators around the streets of Europe, but actually for mass surveillance. The problem from a state perspective was that the U.S. federal government was restrained by courts and constitution and civil society from any kind of law enforcement role. So that by 1898, on the eve of empire, the U.S. federal government actually had no capacity, I mean literally zero capacity, of investigation or policing beyond the very narrow customs barrier. We did, you know, have that at the customs barrier, at the borders of the United States. Beyond that, the federal government didn't have that at all. Okay, what transformed this information revolution from potential to reality was the conquest of the Philippines. And under this extraordinary pressure of this 15-year pacification, 1898 up to about 1912, 1913, which strained the capacities of the U.S. Army to the limit, what they did was is they wired the Philippines with 10,000 miles of copper wire. They brought in this information technology. They created these very sophisticated police forces, the Philippines Constabulary and the Manila Metropolitan Police. And they, Ralph Van Diemen, as the head of the Division of Military Information in the Philippines, which was the U.S. Army's first field intelligence unit, he got the idea of doing a comprehensive survey of every politically active Filipino who might in some way, either as a guerrilla leader or as somebody who was in under U.S. control, actually be a covert supporter of the insurgency. And he came up with the idea of a descriptive card of inhabitants, get all data about every politically active Filipino on a single card, physical description, property, relatives, education, background, experience, 400 army posts across the Philippines transmitting this stuff, this data, via telegraphic wires. The first war in human history, by the way, with real-time battlefield communication via telegraph was the Philippine-American War. So that as they did this pacification, they were transmitting instantaneous data. Okay, so this application of the information revolution to the Philippines allowed us actually to accomplish something that was quite extraordinary. Break Asia's first national revolution militarily, that wasn't hard. But then what was really hard was to undo two generations of national imagining, where colonized people define themselves, you know, not just as the Spanish subjects in the Islas Filipinas,
but as an independent state,
as a people with a distinctive culture and identity, and then to distill that identity, articulate it through newspapers and plays and propaganda sheets and novels. The U.S. government then was faced with the remarkable challenge of not only defeating the Revolutionary Army, but more importantly, winding back these generations of intellectual, cultural, and political mobilization. And that required that the Philippine Constabulary and the Manila Metropolitan Police honeycomb Philippine society with spies and operatives so that every time there was a meeting in Manila, in every newsroom of the nationalist newspaper, there were spies constantly reporting on everybody. And what this system did was it collected all information. It was systematic in its collection of information, the most amazingly scurrilous information, which they were selective in the release. So if you were a supporter of the United States, your dirty secrets would be locked up in files for your life as long as you stayed supportive. If you were an antagonist to the United States, this information would come out in the press and your reputation would be destroyed.
It's like the McCarthy era, only a lot before it.
A lot before. Well, let me give you two examples of the way the system operated. An example of suppression of information. One of the clandestine agents of the Philippines Constabulary was a man named Manuel Quezon. Today, there are, to the best of my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, there are only two of the 200 nations in the world, there are only two national capitals named after a famous political leader, Washington, D.C., after George Washington in the United States, and Quezon City, the capital of the Philippines, the world's 12th largest nation, named after Manuel Quezon. So he's not a small figure. Well, he was back in 1898. He was a revolutionary officer. He was captured, and then he went to law school, became a lawyer, and launched his career. And he was cultivated by constabulary officers, and he became an agent for the constabulary. The founder of the constabulary was a general named Henry T. Allen. Henry T. Allen went from chief of constabulary back to the United States, commander of a division in World War I, commander of the U.S. occupation of the Rhineland at the end of World War I, came back to the United States of Washington, D.C., where he was considered as a Democratic vice presidential nominee but didn't get it. Throughout his entire career, after having tens of thousands of documents cross his desk, Henry T. Allen had one constabulary intelligence report that he kept in his files for his entire life, never released it, and it was called The Short History of MQ, okay? And it's a history of Manuel Quezon written by an American lieutenant in the Division of Military Information, and it says that Quezon's supposed cousin, who was actually his half-sister, that prior to their marriage, she'd gotten pregnant, had an abortion. Quezon had also impregnated her sister. Well, that woman, Doña Aurora, later became the First Lady of the Philippines. Okay? And it goes on that Quezon had captured an American kind of drummer boy in one unit, kept him as kind of a mascot around the house. Then when U.S. forces were approaching his hometown, he had him murdered and buried because he didn't want to be implicated in capturing and holding an American. And it just has more dirt on Quezon you'd ever want to imagine. And this never came out because Quezon, through his entire career, played ball with the constabulary. An example of release, I'll show you how sophisticated the operation is. In the aftermath of the Philippine Revolution, there was a religious schism. There was a nationalist church, rather like the Episcopal Church in the United States broke away from the Anglican Church, okay, as a nationalist schism. Well, in the Philippines, what happened is there was the vicar of the revolution, literally, Bishop Gregorio Aglipay, after the revolution was over, started a thing called the Philippine Independent Church. And so he was a Catholic priest, and he took many of his fellow Catholic priests out. And they got about a third to a half of all the churches in the Philippines under their control. But they had one weakness. When Aglipay broke and he wanted to become a bishop, he knelt on the pavement of the slums of Manila and 12 of his priests laid their hands on him to infuse him with the sacral power of apostolic succession, except for one problem. They all knew that they weren't bishops, that they weren't directly descended, you know, hand to hand to hand from the first bishop of Rome, Peter.
Right.
And therefore, it wasn't a valid apostolic succession. He didn't have really the sacral power to turn bread and wine into the body and blood of Jesus Christ and infuse his priests with the power to do that. Okay, this sacral magic that is handed down. So the problem was, how does he get apostolic succession? How does he get bishops who have been a part of that apostolic succession to put their hands on his head? His solution was the American Episcopal Church. And there was an Episcopal missionary effort in Manila. And so in 1904, there was a convention of the Episcopal bishops in Boston, and that Episcopal missionary bishop in the Philippines was going to that convention and was going to consider an affiliation between the Philippine Independent Church and the Episcopal Church USA, and thus Bishop Aglipay could get that apostolic succession. The head of the constabulary, General Allen, wrote a report, or actually had his intelligence unit write up a report on Aglipay's history, alleging that when he was a priest during the Revolution, he had cruised the halls of the convent seeking nuns and schoolgirls to prey upon, that he had ordered the former Spanish bishop who was captured by the Revolution flogged 300 times. That didn't happen. It was complete disinformation. For the price of a postage stamp, this report on Aglipay was received by the Episcopal bishops. They went into closed session, cut off any negotiations, and indeed, that affiliation, instead of happening in 1904, when it would have been a real powerful move, was delayed until 1962. Eventually it happened, but only after independence. Well, this whole system migrated home to the United States during World War I, and we might want to talk about that a bit.
Government by blackmail.
Yeah.
More on the United States and the Philippines and the rise of the surveillance state when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Support for WPR comes from the Independent Living Council of Wisconsin, which allows the public to comment on how programs for people with disabilities can better meet the needs of consumers at its next meeting, November 10th and 11th in Menominee. More information at ilcw.org.
I have read carefully the Treaty of Paris, and I have seen that we do not intend to free but to subjugate the people of the Philippines. We have gone there to conquer, not to redeem. It should, it seems to me, be our pleasure and duty to make those people free and let them deal with their own domestic questions in their own way. And so I am an anti-imperialist. I am opposed to having the eagle put its talons in any other land. That's Mark Twain writing in the New York Herald, October 15th, 1900. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Alfred McCoy, and we're looking at the Philippine occupation by the United States in the early years of the 20th century and how that affected the use of surveillance techniques at home, despite previous constitutional blocks to some of those techniques. Once the United States has this military and, I guess, bureaucratic and governmental toehold in the Philippines, how did the military and political leaders dig in deeper?
The U.S. pacification of the Philippines, which is considered, if you will, a sort of textbook success in counterinsurgency, operated through a subtle interplay of carrot and stick. On the stick side, the U.S. military operations were massive and very brutal. We mobilized at peak about 75,000 U.S. forces for a population of 6 million, which is an enormous military presence.
What were the casualties?
Casualties on U.S. side were 4,200. The casualties on the Philippine side were as high as 200,000 through the disruption of the pacification. Most civilians who die in war don't die of bullets. They die of disease and hunger. The disruption, and it was a very heavy-handed pacification.
Makes that word pacification seem a little ironic.
Well, pacification with the sword and fire, yeah. And that's what it came in the end. In the end, the kind of redoubts of the revolution were broken by having U.S. Army forces march through and burn the crops, kill the animals, round up the population, confine them in concentration camps. In order to find out where the guerrillas were, they developed something called the water cure, which is waterboarding, and it was done by U.S. Army field forces to extract intelligence from the guerrillas. It was enormously brutal and controversial. At the same time, however, the U.S. civil authorities began building a close relationship with both the Philippine political elite, working out an alliance which convinced them that the United States could become the vehicle for the realization of their aspirations for nationhood and development, and also developed ties to the people by introducing mass education, compulsory universal education for 4 years for all children, and delivering roads, infrastructure, social services. So it was a combination of harshness and, if you will, softness merged together, mediated through this alliance with the Philippine political elite that produced a working relationship. So in 1946, at a time when Britain, France, and Holland were fighting brutal and colonial wars elsewhere in Southeast Asia, there was a nice little ceremony in downtown Manila where Americans and Filipinos, having worked out a close relationship during colonialism, negotiated the terms of independence. We had a ceremony where in downtown Manila on July 4th, 1946, we gave them the 4th, our very best, our very own day. They, of course, later on changed it. But anyway, the American flag came down the flagpole and the Filipino flag went up and they paused and the two flags kind of fluttered at each other. Bye, bye. And the American flag came down and folded up and the Philippine flag went up and that was independence. Yet it wasn't really, because unlike Holland, which was sort of retreating to become a small, dynamic European power, the United States had gone from being a small colonial power via World War II to becoming the world's preeminent superpower. And so the United States decided that we needed the Philippines. And throughout the Cold War, indeed right up to the present, we preserved a special post-colonial relationship mediated via a military alliance, which made the Philippines, if you will, not only a bastion, but a laboratory for the U.S. exercise of global power. During the Cold War in the 1950s, we built 300 bases worldwide. The biggest of those bases was Subic Bay, Philippines, a massive installation. We spent $100 million in building infrastructure there. That was a home port for a major U.S. fleet, the 7th Fleet. Okay, they could do, you know, everything except build ships in Subic Bay.
Why the Philippines? Why did we care so much about having a presence there? And
Because it was strategic and mm-hmm. it was, it's a beautiful deep water port.
And it was up for grabs.
It was up. The Philippine government was willing, because of the post-colonial relationship and our economic and political manipulation, mm-hmm. to let us do it. Very few nations are willing to give you such a port voluntarily. So it was that. And then there was a communist uprising of peasant guerrillas in the late 1940s in the Philippines, one of the first after World War II. And the CIA and the U.S. military developed a very sophisticated psychological warfare and counterinsurgency techniques, which created a cadre and a policy that we applied in South Vietnam that got us really involved in Vietnam and the Vietnam War. So that was the first one. During the 1980s, when in the aftermath of Vietnam under the Reagan administration, we faced again another round of insurgency worldwide, the Philippines became another laboratory for the development of the doctrine of what was called low-intensity warfare, of using vigilante groups, Christian fundamentalist groups, in order to fight communists at a local level. So that throughout the Cold War, the Philippines really remained a laboratory for counterinsurgency, just as it was from 1898 up to 1910.
Was it to what extent was the Philippines a democratically run country?
It had a very vibrant democracy. The problem is, of course, is that one of the U.S. failings throughout this period is by creating and sustaining this very powerful coercive apparatus. We gave the Philippine political and economic elite club, which allowed them to use coercion and control to maintain their political position so that they didn't actually have to negotiate with, let's say, the peasant guerrillas in the 1940s and 1950s. They could just break them, okay? So that you got this enormous spread between a very powerful, very wealthy oligarch and an impoverished mass, just to cite the most potent example, I suppose, is today over 60% of the people in Manila live in squatter settlements. They're living in little alleyways, squatting on land with, you know, marginal access to water and electricity and social services. It's an incredibly impoverished country. And there's this vast diaspora. So where's the Philippine middle class? There are 10 million of them all over the world. The crews on ships on the high seas, they're Filipinos. The doctors across the northern tier of the United States, they're Filipino. The nurses in hospitals across America, Filipino. One could go on. There's this enormously creative, dynamic Filipino middle class that isn't in the Philippines. It's worldwide. It's this great diaspora. So that's the failing of that system.
Can you say something about the Marcos regime?
The Marcos regime was another one of these exercises in using the Philippines as a laboratory for U.S. techniques. Marcos canceled Philippine democracy, our creation, for 14 years. Instead of objecting, we endorsed it. Why? Because he played the basis card brilliantly and made it clear that if we in any way disagree with him or challenged him over human rights, he would threaten the lease on the basis.
Ultimately happened anyway, though.
But after he fell from power, and by virtue of nature, Mount Pinatubo erupted and that kind of...
Trumped everything.
And the Philippine Senate in the midst of that didn't go along, and the Cold War was over, and that crisis, the convergence between nature's eruptions and the shifting, if you will, in global geopolitics brought that together. But at this point in the 1970s, 1980s, that was the height of the Cold War. The bases were still critically important, an anchor in the chain of our anti-communist containment, ringing the Iron Curtain. And Marcos played that brilliantly. And so we gave him extensive military aid, and we helped train his top anti-subversion officers who came to the United States for sophisticated torture training. And so his regime, in fact, had a horrific human rights record, although we queried it and we pushed a little about it. Ultimately, President Carter, even at a time when he was pushing human rights worldwide, had to back away from that.
And we have Imelda Marcos, sort of, I don't know, the Marie Antoinette type approach, sort of reinforcing what you just said about the split between the rich and the poor.
Yeah, the personification, if you will, of that gap is outrageous self-indulgent consumption. You know, world-class shopping expeditions, and to the point where she became a one-woman fiscal whirlwind, a one-woman fiscal disaster.
3,000 pairs of shoes. That was the number given.
That's our capacity to comprehend.
I know that historians don't necessarily like to go back and imagine what would have happened if something else had taken place, but it's hard to imagine the Philippines had the United States stayed out of the way. In other words, after Spain left and the Philippines could have moved at the turn of the century into independence, had we not become involved. A different story.
They would have, in all likelihood, established a republic that would have gone through the same process of nation-state formation with all the vicissitudes and travails that, let's say, the nations of Latin America went through and are still going through today. But they would have done it on their own. It's called counterfactual history. Another counterfactual point, supposing we'd really cut the tie in 1946, that when that flag came down, that was the end of it. We hadn't, in fact, developed this protracted post-colonial relationship that ran from 1947 to 1992, where we made the Philippines the site of two of our biggest bases worldwide, Clark Field and Subic Bay. If we'd walked away, what would have happened then? Well, the Philippine state wouldn't have had the capacity to defeat the communist and socialist and if you will, kind of agrarian radical revolutionaries in the Philippines. They would have had to do what they were doing before we began intervening. They would have had to sit down and negotiate. This is what happened in Central America at the end of the Cold War. You know, there was a negotiated settlement in El Salvador, a negotiated settlement in Guatemala. Once we pull back, the social forces that were polarizing come together and they settle it, other than by means of arms, because it's too brutal. One could imagine, hypothetically, that you would have had a much more liberal government that would have emphasized both economic development that would advantage the entrepreneurial elite, but also social development that would have created schools and public health that would have lifted up the whole of the society so that the Filipinos wouldn't be living in the absolute misery and poverty that they are today, and they wouldn't have lost their dynamic middle class. They would have a really vibrant, dynamic democracy.
What did the United States gain from those, say, 45 years of control of the Philippines?
We gained a very important asset and bastion for the conduct of the Cold War and for the exercise of global power. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, Subic Bay was enormously important in its day. Between Japan and the coast of Africa, that vast arc of the globe, that was the ambit of the U.S. Seventh Fleet.
And what was the darker side of what the result of that occupation of the Philippines was? That in a moment when we return. This is University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from IDEAS, a web-based clearinghouse for classroom-tested student and teacher resources, including interactive lesson plans. Online at ideas.wisconsin.edu.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Alfred McCoy, and his most recent book is Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. We've been talking about the Philippines as a kind of laboratory with all sorts of surveillance techniques and military exercises taking place. What happens when those techniques come back to the United States?
They had a profound impact upon the United States. During the crisis surrounding World War I, the United States imported personnel, precedents, and policies from the Philippines to create its internal security apparatus. At the start of World War I, the United States was the only combatant that didn't have an intelligence unit in its military, which is extraordinary. The European armies had had them for the better part of a century. We had a small fledgling unit from the 1890s through 1908 when the U.S. Army abolished it, thinking it wasn't needed. Well, at the start of World War One, when intelligence was critically important, we didn't have one.
You mean we didn't have a CIA, FBI type thing?
The FBI was a tiny fledgling unit called the Bureau of Investigation. The Office of Naval Intelligence was several hundred officers. And the U.S. Army had no intelligence unit whatsoever. And there was basically no U.S. internal security or external intelligence apparatus. Okay, it was either non-existent or fledgling.
So did we suddenly feel a need for one?
The U.S. Secretary of War felt they needed one, and they turned to our only military officer with sustained experience of intelligence, in this case in the Philippines, Ralph Van Diemen. And he was made first commander and the founder of the Military Intelligence Division inside the U.S. Army. He started with two people, himself and a former aide from the Philippines, and within weeks he had built an entire intelligence service of 1,700 men with a complete doctrine for intelligence and counterintelligence. He established the Corps of Intelligence Police, which is today the U.S. Counterintelligence Corps, and another Philippine veteran, Dennis Nolan, who served in the Constabulary in the Philippines, established the Field Intelligence Unit in General Pershing's command in Europe. That meant that this entire military intelligence division in the United States, because of the nature of communications, really couldn't play a role in the fighting in World War I. So what was it doing? It wasn't doing intelligence. It was doing counterintelligence. It was trying to root out German spies. And it took the Philippine model, which was colonial in character, white officers with a Filipino civilian adjunct, and applied it to the United States. So what you had was the military intelligence division of regular soldiers. And then Van Diemen acquired a civilian adjunct, a kind of auxiliary, called the American Protective League, which had 300,000 badge-carrying civilian spies, okay, collecting information on German Americans mainly all across the country. When I was doing this research, I was stunned to find in the records of the Military Intelligence Division my grandfather's handwritten letters to my great-grandmother, because my mother's family is German-American from New York. And my grandfather was a lab technician based in a military hospital, Army hospital in North Carolina. Well, those spies reached, you know, he's a German-American, he's a target, you know, and so I could find my grandfather's letter to my great-grandmother, you know, in the files of the military intelligence.
Somebody got it somehow.
It was an Army intelligence spy monitoring the ranks, okay? So now, this didn't end with the end of World War I. This model continued. And it honeycombed American society for the next 50 years.
What were we concerned about, though, after the war? Communists?
The labor radicals, the Wobblies, the IWW, subversives of socialists, and then the communists in the 1920s. So after the war, there was an upsurge of labor radicalism, enormous labor radicalism. There were dock strikes in New York and on the West Coast. The most important thing was a coal strike in an era, of course, when coal was the energy source of energy for American industry. There was a United Mine Workers launched a major nationwide strike, and then they were defeated because there was one part of the coal production that they didn't actually take out, the southern tier of West Virginia. So the United Mine Workers decided to go in and organize. And it's the only armed revolt that the United States faced throughout the 20th century. 18,000 miners in West Virginia, armed with infantry weapons, formed a firing line against sheriff's deputies and private security officers. And another Philippine veteran, a former chief of constabulary, a man named Harry Bandholz, who was also founder of the U.S. military police in World War I, he came into West Virginia on his own, and he coordinated an operation that broke that strike using the same kind of techniques he developed in the Philippines. But this alliance between the FBI and the civilian auxiliaries continued for 50 years. I mean, the American Protective League was abolished, but U.S. Army Military Intelligence presided over the establishment of the American Legion. And they turned the American Legion, this organization of returning veterans, into an adjunct. So when they were, you know, raiding socialist bookstores in Milwaukee and all across the Midwest, they mobilized the American Legion chapters for kind of mob violence. And they broke the Wobblies. Then they had to deal with the Communist Party. Van Diemen himself retired from the U.S. Army in 1929, and he, I think, is an example of how this operated. From 1929 to his death in 1952, he built up a private archive of files on 250,000 suspected communists. And even though he was retired and had no security clearance, he was getting top-secret reports from the FBI. He was very close to J. Edgar Hoover, from U.S. Military Intelligence, Office of Naval Intelligence, from the police red squads that were operating in San Diego and Los Angeles. He was centralizing this information. So what he became was a vehicle for moving this highly classified confidential material from government files through his archive into the hands of citizen activists. So, for example, in 1946, an obscure Los Angeles lawyer who had never before held public office named Richard Nixon decided to run against a very popular liberal Democratic congressman, Congressman Jerry Voorhees. And so at Nixon rallies, there were these pink sheets accusing Voorhees of being a communist, all right? It is believed that Van Diemen's archives were the source of the dirt on Jerry Voorhees. In 1950, Nixon then ran for the U.S. Senate against a liberal actress and senator, Helen Gahagan Douglas. Again, more pink sheets believed to come from the Van Diemen archives, catapulting Nixon from obscurity on a path to the presidency as an anti-communist.
Do you have trouble not becoming a cynic? I was just thinking, all the research that you've done on this, it must be hard not to feel immensely cynical.
Well, no, it's just how it's the distinctive attribute of how the American state exercises its power.
But it's so sinister, isn't it?
It's not pleasant, no, but it's how states operate. All states have internal security apparatuses. They have histories. They influence the visible surface of politics. I'm not a cynic. I'm a realist, okay? That I would argue that many of my fellow historians are writing kind of adult bedtime stories about great leaders thinking great thoughts and making, you know, uplifting speeches. And that's the sum of politics. Yes, that's a very important aspect of political life. I, too, am uplifted by those speeches. We need them as a citizenry. But there's a dark underside to the exercise of state power in every modern society. And America has its own way of doing it. It has a history. What I find extraordinary is that this was all there to be discovered. I mean, there are 10,000 historians working in the United States. Why did it fall to me to find this? It was there to be found. It's an extraordinary story.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Parallels with today's intelligence gathering and surveillance and homeland security and all that.
Well, Mark Twain was right. You can't have an empire abroad and democracy at home. And every time you exercise that power abroad, you do damage to democracy at home. Let's first of all talk about the global war on terror and what it's done. This has been, again, one of those wars that has strained the capacities of the American state to its absolute limit. We're not fighting just one pacification campaign like we did in the Philippines after 1898. We're fighting really four simultaneous pacification campaigns across a vast arc of the globe, from Somalia through Iraq, Afghanistan, and somewhat into Pakistan, then all the way to the Philippines. And this extraordinary pressure on the U.S. government, first of all, looked like the makings of disaster. Iraq erupted in guerrilla warfare. We couldn't tamp it down through our conventional methods. So what do we do? Well, what we did was we took our existing technologies, which are quite sophisticated, and just as we had done in the Philippines after 1898, we merged them to create these powerful forces, the Philippine Constabulary and the Manila Metropolitan Police, who are using cutting-edge information technology to penetrate and control society. We did the same thing in Iraq. And this first became evident right after the battle for Fallujah in late 2004. Our bombardment of Fallujah destroyed and damaged over half the houses in that city. The population of 250,000 fled in the midst of this war zone in their city. So after it was over, the U.S. Marines established a cordon around the city, set up four checkpoints, and took months to allow the population to return because people had to stand in the sun and they had to be fingerprinted and they had to get a retinal scan. And these retinal scans went into a biometric database based in West Virginia, linked by satellite, so that every resident of Fallujah had to wear a tag that could then be checked against the database so that any infiltrator could be caught. Well, then in 2007, I saw a photograph in the New York Times that I reproduced in the book, which was the first indication that we were attempting the same thing in Baghdad, a city of 7 million, a much more difficult target. And the photograph showed two American soldiers holding open wide an Iraqi's eyeball to take a picture of his retina. And it turned out, 8 months later, the Washington Post revealed that we'd built a database of 1 million out of the 7 million people, a database of 1 million retinal scans and fingerprints. So U.S. forces sweeping down the streets of Baghdad and going into houses, kicking down the doors and wondering, you know, who is this kid? You know, I'm a cousin. No, okay. Scan the eyeball, pop it via satellite to West Virginia, get confirmation or not. And then we had the surge, President Bush's escalation of our forces on the ground. Okay, we all thought more boots on the ground made the surge work and allowed us to stabilize the situation. But Bob Woodward came out with his book last year and he made the argument. He didn't elaborate, but he said it wasn't the boots on the ground. It was bullets to the head. That the Joint Special Operations Command, okay, the most secret and sophisticated of the U.S. units under General McChrystal, now our commander in Afghanistan, had used every available technology, telephone intercepts, satellite information, in order to assassinate everybody who was either a wavering middle ground person, a sheikh that was playing us on both sides, the al-Qaeda in Iraq. We don't know, but, you know, hundreds of assassinations were critical to the pacification of the country. We've also developed extremely sophisticated techniques, which are now, I think, all concentrated in the Predator drones.
Okay? Yes, last August, we read about those.
Right, last August, for example, Baitullah Masood, the head of the Taliban in Pakistan, at night was on his rooftop. Zap, he was hit by a Predator drone. He was incinerated on his rooftop. That involved very sophisticated signals intercept, cell phone monitoring, very skillful digital imagery, all right? Precise GPS, drawing together all these technologies into this lethal apparatus. Now, this stuff has begun to percolate home. First of all, at home, under the war on terror, President Bush presided over the National Security Agency and the FBI doing deep data mining. And the NSA's Operation Pinwheel and the FBI's investigated data warehouse have literally several billion U.S. domestic documents, driver's licenses, social security reports, police reports, approaching at least 2 billion documents sucked into these deep data mining warehouses. They're accessed by tens of thousands of operatives, security operatives, who are making 1 million-plus searches a month into this database. Simultaneously, these forces in Iraq that have become extremely sophisticated in the use of this electronic information have come home. In September of last year, the first of these Iraqi battalions who had the sophisticated capacity came home and they became the consequent incident management force. Okay, and the General Casey, Chief of Staff of the Army at Fort Stewart, Georgia, in September of last year, presided on the first readiness exercise, the first war games in which the military using these techniques would war game the repression of a civil disturbance, coordinating with FEMA and the FBI and local police authorities. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a case wanting to know the history of this deployment, the details of this deployment, saying that this deployment represents a fundamental threat to American democracy. President Obama has not changed any of this. In fact, he's deepened it. Predator drone strikes have gone up abroad. Data mining has spread. Moreover, President Obama is moving us from defense to offense, and he's set up a new cyber command inside the Pentagon, and he has stated, you know, I can promise you that we will never transgress. We will not be looking at U.S. domestic records. But the top Pentagon experts working in this field said that the bright line, the boundary, is impossible to observe. Of course you'll be transgressing. Of course you'll be deep data mining. What does this mean? Well, the United Kingdom represents, I think, Great Britain today represents a kind of, you know, a prototype of where we're going. When I just came back from a trip to the UK, and one thing that struck me as I took a train from Manchester across the breadth of England was that we went through every train yard, every city. I could see from the rail track these white video cameras everywhere.
Yep.
Okay? There are three task forces in the British police who operate a secret centralized database in London, and they have all the dissidents, people that turn up at all kinds of demonstrations. They're photographed, their images are scanned, they're all in a database, all right? And this allows British police to photograph a crowd, tap into that database, identify people.
Big Brother
is watching. What we're looking at is, you know, the next time there's an attack on America, we could draw together this technology developed abroad and these forces that have now war-gamed their ability with this deep data mining to create in the United States, the reality of a digital surveillance state.
Our guest has been Alfred McCoy. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.